This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with John McGinnis. He's been covering Louisiana politics for four decades, and we'll talk with him about what's going on as we approach the 2014 U.S. Senate election, with Mary Landrieu seeking re-election against the likes of Congressman Bill Cassidy. Also, the Louisiana Senate is now two-thirds Republican. Quite a change from when John McGinnis first started covering the Capitol. Also on the show, Eric Lane and Leo Honeycutt on the death of Matt Batts, a baseball legend who was 91 years old and was living here in Baton Rouge when he died Sunday. We'll talk with Leo and Eric about the legacy of Matt Batts. And Kim Ritchie Spencer, The Thinking Mom's Revolution, a compelling book about autism. Now the news. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with John McGinnis. He's been covering Louisiana politics for four decades, the author of The Last Hayride, Cross to Bear. And it's been an interesting year, as it usually is, as John McGinnis trolled the halls of the Capitol in a regular session for the 40th time. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Seems like yesterday.
Seems like yesterday. You and Edwin Edwards came in at about the same time, right?
That's right. I just got out of the Navy, and it was his first year in office, and I thought, why should I leave Louisiana?
So John McGinnis and Edwin Edwards started, and it's amazing you're still doing your things, your respective things.
Well, indeed. I've been real fortunate, and a lot has changed in this business over the years. When I started out, they weren't even fax machines, and then on to email and like that. But I've managed to keep up with the changes, and I found there's always been a need and an interest, a thirst for political information, and there's always been a lot of news like that in Louisiana.
When did the Facts Weekly begin?
1993. And I just finished Cross to Bear and was kind of, you know, I'd been through several different publishing ventures like Gree-Gree and the Baton Rouge Enterprise, and not all of them ended well, and was looking for a way to be able to publish without having to, deal with the printing press and ad reps and graphics people, and the fax machine was, it was a great invention. It freed me from all of that and allowed me to communicate directly with my readers and have them pay for the paper and ink.
And subscriber number one was?
Jim Harris, God bless him, and still going strong. Jim Harris has been around Louisiana politics longer than I have, but he is government consultant. He was back in those days, and earlier than that, he was one of Edwin Edwards' first press secretaries, but one of the most knowledgeable people about Louisiana politics, and one of the real gentlemen, too. I love him.
Harris DeVille is his
indeed
company. Who was subscriber two?
Still around. Fred Loy. Then he was with, I think, the Committee of 100, but he's retired now, I think, and but he still subscribes, so it goes on. I keep count of who came where. Well, lost a dear subscriber this week, subscriber number nine, a former State Senator Hank Braden died in New Orleans this week, a great loss. He was a wonderful man, great character, and great insights on Louisiana politics and New Orleans politics, and died too young.
Yeah, he was, what, in his 60s, wasn't he?
68 years old.
68 years old. Well, I remember when LSU basketball was going strong under Dale Brown, people were leaving their tickets and their wills to their loved ones, and maybe someone will leave a subscription to lawpolitics.com in their will.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
There you go.
If they haven't already. I do have some survivors of Michael Baychak is one. His dad, Shelley Baychak, was one of my early subscribers. Shelley died years ago, and Michael has been a long-time subscriber. He and Trey Urso, his partner.
All right, 877-217-5757, wherever you are, for John McGinnis. When John started covering the Capitol in the early 70s, I don't know if there was a Republican in the Louisiana Senate then.
No, not in the early 70s, I don't believe. I'm thinking that Ken Hollis was the first one in modern times.
And he was elected in 82.
Right, and so no, there weren't many. There weren't many African Americans. There were some. I came in right after the great reapportionment of 1971 with the single member districts. I don't really think that started in 1968, but then we had reapportionment in the 1970s, and it really brought in a whole new class of many new legislators, and some of them still around, like John Lario, Francis Thompson, and I guess the class that came in when Bobby Jindal's first term was also a real new class, in that it was a lot of people coming in after a term limits kicked in.
Right. Well, 1973, 40 years ago, there were 39 white Democrats in the Louisiana Senate. Today, there are 5 white Democrats.
And that's something.
What happened?
Well, Louisiana, I believe, caught up with the movement in the South toward the Republican Party, which really started in the Civil Rights era and really, I think, accelerated with President Reagan and the Reagan Democrats, who became Republicans, and once it accelerated, it just took over. Although, still, many of the people who are registered Republicans now, former Democrats, they still vote the same way. They were conservative Democrats then, and they could be populist at times, and they still are.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting time, and of the 5 Democrats, one of those is Francis Thompson. With Ricky Ward switching the other day to the GOP, that gives the Republicans a 26-13 majority in the Senate, 2/3. My guess, John, is that at some point, you and I may be talking about 30 Republicans in the Senate.
Might be talking about a few more black Democrats, too. Francis Thompson represents a majority black district, and so does David Heitmeyer in New Orleans. And one day those districts may go with an African-American. Don't think there's many more Republican seats that you're going to pick up in the Senate, though.
You think that's the 26 is pretty close to the top.
2/3 is plenty.
Well, yeah, it is. It is, and it's happened so fast.
Yeah. Now, once it got accelerated and going, it really just took off. And a guy like Rick Ward, his district is 35% African American. It sort of wraps around Baton Rouge, around on the north and west side, and takes in a lot of areas that. Real Democrat areas, although Bobby Jindal covered all those one of those areas, and Barack Obama lost. So they are marginally Republican performance districts. But what a politician looks at today is who could be someone who could run against you, and usually it's a potential Republican opponent would be one who would be well financed and could be more of a threat to you than a white Democrat or a black Democrat, and that may have been part of the calculus in Senator Ward, and also looking at his political future. If he ever wanted to run for something higher, I'm not saying he will, but if he were ever to look at running for Congress or like that, being a Republican in the 6th District would serve you better than being a Democrat.
Rare is the politician today who will say, I'm not switching parties, even if it costs me my job.
That's true. And in Louisiana, it's not seen as a big deal. In other states, it is. State of New York, there was someone who just got indicted this year because, he had to try and bribe somebody to get on the ballot because he was trying to change parties. And here, it's just a matter of going into the registrar's office. And it's just not seen as a real big deal here.
All right.
And nor should it be. And with a lot of these guys who have switched parties, and I'm thinking of Representative Jim Fannin up in North Louisiana, you know, they don't change their stripes so much as they may change their jerseys.
That's a good line. They don't change.
I've used it before.
Well, Mary Landrieu's never changed parties, and she's the last Democrat standing far as a statewide elected official, and she is right now being challenged by somebody.
She will have a real test.
Who did change parties?
2014.
Bill Cassidy was a Democrat who became a Republican and started running for office and hasn't lost since. How formidable a candidate will he be?
Very. It will be another stiff challenge for Senator Landrieu. Bill Cassidy is not well known around the whole state, but the $3 million he has in the bank will start to change that. He'll have a lot more before next year. And then also you have to factor in the outside groups outside the state, both Democrat and Republican leaning, who are going to spend a lot of money in next year's election, because Louisiana is essential for the Republicans to capture a majority in the Senate. They got to win this seat here, so there's going to be a lot of money come to play. And but Cassidy has to become better known, but I'm no doubt that he will. But he has a strong story to tell as a being a doctor and a charity hospital doctor. Having been a Democrat, they have made some votes in the past and in Congress that have not sat well with the real right wing of the Republican Party, and that could cause him some problems. There is another Republican out running who calls himself a constitutional conservative, Rob Manis, who's more of a Tea Party favorite, but he's just getting started, just scratching the surface on raising money. Bill Cassidy is going to be the as things stand right now, he certainly is going to be the main Republican challenger to Mary Landrieu. But if you have a guy like Rob Manis, who runs just a strong campaign and works at it, he could easily get enough votes to throw this thing into a runoff in December in 2014. And then what if the balance of control of the Senate hung on the Louisiana election, December runoff in 2014. Boy, there'll be probably more attention than we want to have focused on Louisiana.
Well, Landrieu's been through this once before with Susie Terrell.
She had a December runoff then, and it was, and oftentimes the mood of the country switches from November to December. Sometimes it switches in favor of Republicans. And case of 2002 with Landrieu, it switched in favor of the Democrats, and she won that runoff.
I remember she got 46% in the primary and forced into a runoff, and Susie Terrell, who had received 27%, was being picked by a lot of people to win, including Buddy Romer, who said it was a 100% lock cinch that Susie Terrell would be the next U.S. Senator. Yeah. Buddy was wrong.
He was wrong. That election changed just in the last few days. That was quite a race then.
Yeah, and remember Tip O'Neill saying of Buddy Romer, often wrong, never in doubt. Now, any chance Governor Jindal's going to get in this, or is that over?
He pretty emphatically said he's not going to run for the U.S. Senate, so I guess we have to take him at his word, and that he will finish his term, which will be, even he has joked that that'll be a first. He said, once that he's in the sixth year of his job as governor, and it's the longest he's been in any one place since the sixth grade.
Well, we've heard other people say they wouldn't do something. Bill Clinton said he wouldn't run for president, and he did. Nick Saban said he wouldn't go to Alabama.
Mitch Landrieu said he wouldn't run for mayor of New Orleans.
That's right, he did. But
the governor, very recently, very emphatically said he's not going to run for the U.S. Senate. And of course, some of people say the U.S. Senate is not a really fun place to be these days, and particularly if you're the kind of political stripe like Bobby Jindal, maybe he just doesn't want to be one of 100. He likes being number one.
Oh, he likes being number one. I'm sure he's running for president, but maybe being in the U.S. Senate would be an easier way to get there. It may not be his time. We'll talk with John McGinnis about whether 2016 will result in the election of Bobby Jindal as President of the United States, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Works online. And John McGinnis is with us for just a bit longer, putting out another issue of LawPolitics.com. And we were talking about Governor Jindal seeking the White House in 2016. Earlier this week, I read Bob Mann's assessment saying it was a preposterous adventure for Governor Jindal. That's not likely to stop the governor, is it, John?
No, it isn't. You know, these tides change pretty quickly, and thinking about a presidential election 3 years ago, trying to say someone who's definitely in or definitely out is, you know, probably misplaced. Certainly he has a lot of odds running against him, but that hadn't stopped others in the past. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that, you know, Jindal, his preoccupation is running, being president. I think his more goal is to be a player. And if that means entering some primaries and or not, he's going to be a factor in the presidential election of 2016. You know how at the run-up to the last year's election, just in late October, when already people were looking ahead to 2016, Chris Christie was seen as, oh, he's going to be a strong candidate, and Marco Rubio was almost a lock cinch. Well, since then, Chris Christie has fallen out of favor with many hardcore Republicans because he actually said something nice about President Obama during the Hurricane Sandy aftermath, and Marco Rubio with the immigration issue has turned on him, and he's seen as losing favor with the hardcore of the Republican Party. So these things change quickly. Right now, if you look at it, who is the real favorite of the, you know, the real conservative movement within the Republican Party, it'd probably be Rick Santorum, the former Pennsylvania senator. You know, he made his run at it this time. He may run at it again. But once you get past him, Jindal is a factor in there as being one of someone who the real conservative wing of the Republican Party could respond to. Now the question is, what kind of candidate can he be? Can he you know, light up a crowd? Can he get people excited about running for him? He's been shown to be lacking in at times at that, but we'll just have to see how things play out, but I believe we're going to see him on the stage at some point.
He wrote a interesting piece for Politico a few weeks ago. We've talked about it, and before we get John's take on it, the governor, of course, said it was time to stop the bedwetting and the navel-gazing and put on our big boy pants and go kick around the other guys. Here's how Foster Campbell responded to the governor's remarks.
Some of the stuff is just silly to talk about, quit bedwetting and put on your big boy pants. I mean, you know, here's a little guy that he's the last person in the world ought to talk about big boy pants.
John, what do you think?
I use that quote in Law Politics.
Did you?
As part of our they said it at the end where we take quotes of the week, and I couldn't resist that. But good old, you rely on Foster Campbell to say something quotable, especially about Bobby Jindal. But yeah, the governor he'll be known for some of those quotes for a while to come. But yeah, writing a column about, you know, the political officials who write columns usually are very forgettable because they try to, you know, not be very careful about what they say and end up nobody remembers what they said. But I think Governor Jindal made an effort to make sure people remembered some of his lines, and he was successful.
Yes, he was. Do you think he wrote it?
He may have. He may have done it with the help of some of his advisors, but I'm sure he had a hand in it, just like he did. I understand his gridiron speech before the Washington Capitol Correspondents. That was a matter of about four or five of he and Timmy Teeple, Wes Anderson, sitting around in the governor's mansion, just throwing out one-liners, and they came up with a pretty good speech. So,
yeah, they did a nice job on that one.
So he probably had a hand in it.
Okay, well, he's not known as a trenchant speaker, and sometimes that matters. Usually, it does when a person's running for president, and that seems to be a big reason why people like Bob Mann say the governor has very little chance is that he doesn't have the television presence of, say, Mitt Romney or others. He's not the most telegenic guy in the world. He's not a bad-looking man, but he's no Mitt Romney.
No, he isn't, but Mitt Romney didn't make it either.
No, he didn't, but if he'd looked like Bobby Jindal, would he have gotten would he have gotten 47% of the votes? He might have gotten more or less. I don't know. I don't know, but Bobby Jindal, I think, will run for president and probably in 2016. Now, you know, it's a case.
And probably 2022 and 2024. He's got a long way to. He has a long life in politics, and that's what I'm saying. Though, I think his goal is to be a player. He's going and maybe there's only there may not be more than a dozen Republicans out there, if that many, who can even. Who will be the kind of factor he will be.
It took Ronald Reagan three times to get elected president. It took Mitch Landrieu three times to be elected mayor of New Orleans, Kip Holden three times to be elected mayor of Baton Rouge, and Shirley asks about Mitch Landrieu. Is there a chance, John, that he will run for governor?
Well, he's got to get reelected first in early next year. That's a possibility that he might just pop up and run for governor. He'd be a strong Democratic candidate. He would have to overcome the, you know, the reticence of voters to elect New Orleans mayors as governors. Chet Morrison tried three times and never made it. So, and then also there'd be assuming if his sister gets reelected next year, then you got the too many Landrieus syndrome. You know, that could put off some voters too. But he, Democratic elected official out there who can appeal to voters across the board as someone who's being competent and efficient and someone who can, you know, talk to voters of every stripe, Mitch Landrieu does fit that.
You were asked this question about a year ago on this show, and I want to direct it at you, but what do you think in general about journalists running for public office?
Well, which ones have recently?
Well, there's one. Kevin has pulled this up, and that's why I'm asking you this. He's a frequent guest on this show, probably once every 6 months. You probably know him, Quinn Hillier. He's running for Congress in Alabama, and Kevin has his spot. Here, Kevin, go.
Tempers boiling about the scandal at the IRS.
The AP is accusing the Obama administration of spying on its reporters. Now.
Another day, another version of exactly what went down in Libya.
Time after time, President Obama betrayed our trust. It's time to fight back. It's time to send a proven conservative leader to Congress. It's Hillier time. Quinn Hillier has been that leader for 30 years. Ronald Reagan appointed Quinn to serve our veterans in the 80s. In the 90s, Quinn worked on the congressional committee that cut $50 billion to balance the budget. As a conservative columnist, Quinn Hillier was among the first to take on both parties for reckless spending and warned us that Obama would misuse the IRS and Justice Department. In Congress, Quinn will fight for jobs, for longer red snapper seasons, for hurricane insurance, and always for Alabama values. That's why it's Hillier time. Learn more at QuinnHillier.com.
I'm Quinn Hillier, and I approve this message.
Paid for by Quinn Hillier for Congress.
All right, that's a spot that Quinn Hillier, a journalist from Louisiana, is running to attempt to be elected into the Congress from the great state of Alabama.
Longer red snapper season. Yeah. You don't often hear that promise out there, do you? But I'm sure that resonates though in Alabama.
Yeah, you got to include that. In fact, there's a look at the sports section today in the Baton Rouge Advocate. The headline: Red Snapper Fall Season Okayed. So. Well, red snappers often determine elections.
Yeah.
But Quinn Hillier is a guy who has decided to get in the arena.
Yeah, and he's been a columnist. He's been, but more recently he's worked as a political operative. You know, things are just a lot more fluid these days. And who calls himself a journalist and what your background is in running for office. But the important thing is that they're out there. They're involved in the political process, and sooner or later they want to take their shot. So best of luck to Quinn.
You know, Quinn's former boss is Bob Livingston, who was a congressman,
right,
who came within a whisker of being Speaker of the House. And a few weeks ago, I decided to give him a call, and he said he'd come on the show reluctantly for a segment, and he did, and kept his word. But he said, you know, he really doesn't like doing these things. And sure enough, the congressman, I don't think he realized it at the time, but he put his foot in his mouth, according to some. I got a few responses that were not too charitable about this statement from Congressman Livingston on this show.
The poor have so many lobbyists in this town that they outnumber. In fact, the social programs have grown exponentially in recent years. This government is doing more for the poor than it ever did in the history of the nation.
Bob Livingston saying the poor are overrepresented on Capitol Hill.
I'm going to go down K Street and see how many lobbyists for the poor there are. I don't know.
Well, and Bob Livingston has done very well. The first year he was out of Congress, he got a $7 million contract to represent the country of Turkey as a lobbyist. So,
well, he's done well as a lobbyist, and to his credit, you know, whenever I call him, he's responsive. He went on your show. He will respond to a journalist with a question. So I respect that about Bob.
He's a nice man, and he acknowledges that his shortcomings cost the state of Louisiana a whole lot. Imagine if we had had the Speaker of the House from this state.
Well, that's what I thought. What would have happened had the 17th Street Canal, had the levee broken in the district of the Speaker of the House? The outcome of Hurricane Katrina may have been different.
I would imagine.
And maybe that levee wouldn't have broken. It may have been quite fortified.
You're right. It may not have. Well, John, it's always a pleasure,
right,
to talk with you. Let's do
all
it
right,
again.
Jim.
Thanks.
Right,
bye-bye. 297-5633 is your number, and we're going to be joined in a moment by some folks who are familiar with a gentleman named Matt Batts. Played baseball for a number of years in the major leagues and was the first catcher to take a pitch from the legendary Satchel Paige. Matt Batts was a guy who lived his life, much of it, in his retired years right here in our community. He died Sunday at the age of 91, a great name for a baseball player, Matt Batts. And Leo Honeycutt, who seems to know everybody in town, wrote the obituary that is in today's paper, a very long and well-written obituary. Leo, how in the world did you get connected to Matt Batts?
Well, his daughter Denise, who is with us right now. And
we'll hear from her in a minute.
Denise had we were working on another project, and she asked me if I would be interested in writing. And honestly, I really hadn't kept up with Major League Baseball too much. But when I went back and looked, I said, "Wait, this guy's been in Baton Rouge? What?" and then Eric had worked with him. Eric Lane, you know, over Jerry Lane, had worked with him in those kids' clinics. Oh yeah, man, this guy was great. He was always all he gave his time. He gave the printing. He gave, you know, all. This was a major league player. This guy was one of the first catchers with Satchel Paige when he broke the color barrier in 1951.
When Satchel Paige was the first black pitcher in the
right.
American League, I believe.
Right.
And, of course, a legendary pitcher, Hall of Famer, and Matt Batts took the pitch from the great Satchel Paige. And speaking of catchers, Eric Lane was quite a catcher in his day. First for Tulane. I remember when he was hitting home runs against LSU, and then he played several years in the Kansas City Royals organization,
and
the San Francisco Giants. Can you come to the microphone, Eric? And how did you first meet Matt?
Well, I came to the clinic in 1984 as a minor league player for the first time to attend the clinic. Joe Brockoff had asked me to come attend the clinic and help him with the instruction. Of course, Matt, being a catcher, I got to meet him right away because he was helping instruct the catchers. And, of course, when you were a minor leaguer, you got to go to Brule or you went to Gonzales to the other ballparks over there. The major league players got to go to Alex Box Stadium to work with LSU right. with the kids there. So I got sent to Brule to work with the catchers over there. But I got to meet Matt, and then I became a regular clinic attender and instructor. And then, of course, I ended up becoming vice president of the clinic in 91 and found out that Matt was the one doing all the printing for the programs, for the banquet that we had. He was printing tickets for the raffle, all of that, you know, free of charge, helping the clinic out every chance he could. Just a wonderful guy.
Well, I see Eric Lane, who knows a good catcher when he sees one, drafted in the eighth round by the Rangers in 82. Two did not sign.
Right, I went back to school, got my degree.
Then waited a year and signed out of Tulane with the San Francisco Giants after being drafted in the ninth round. Played for the Shreveport Captains. How about that?
Sure.
So,
did.
Matt Batts was a guy who was 91 years old when he died, and most folks probably didn't realize that he lived right here in our midst and was a guy with a great legacy as far as his major league career. And Leo, why don't you introduce Denise?
Well, Denise, of course, knew him from the other side as a father. So, but, you know, part of the reason why I got involved with this, too, is because his story is yet another story about giving. His story is yet another story about sacrificing your own personal gain for the better good of the community. And unfortunately, we don't see that many stories of that. And I think that one thing that I've learned from this and even from Edwin Edwards and from Jerry Lane especially is that you just really can't outgive God. I mean, you hear that phrase a lot, but it really is true. You can't, the more you give, the more you do receive. It's just that our culture sometimes teaches us to hoard and to try to do only for ourselves and to be kind of selfish. But when you see these pockets of people who actually give of themselves, it makes such a difference in so many different lives, and Matt Batts is one of those examples. So, you know, so Denise, I'm sure, did he want you to play Major League Baseball?
I'm sure he wished he had some boys. He sure made us athletic anyway.
Well, visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Saturday at Ravenhorse downtown with a memorial service to be officiated by Dr. Ken Ward. And Matt Batts played in the 40s and in the 50s in the major leagues, was quite a player and quite a man, certainly getting many plaudits as we find out much more about him now in his passing at the age of 91. I would imagine most of the players, Denise, that he was associated with are long gone.
We were just talking to someone from the St. Louis Browns last week, and they were saying that of the St. Louis Browns, Dad was the ninth oldest. And I think in the last week they lost two or three of them. So, yeah, it's dwindling down. Virgil Trucks was one of his best friends, and we lost him just a couple months ago.
Virgil Fire Trucks, who has the distinction of throwing two no-hitters in one season, your dad caught one of those.
He did indeed.
And if I remember right, Virgil's record that year when he threw the two no-hitters was 5-16. So when he was on, and when he was off, well, that's a different story. But your dad was with him when he threw a no-hitter, and some catchers go through their whole careers without catching a no-hitter. But your dad caught Virgil Fire Trucks. And Matt Batts, what a great name! He lived in Baton Rouge for how long?
Well, oh boy, that's since 1958.
So
that's correct.
55 years.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a bit more with
Baton Rouge was definitely his home.
Denise Batts, Eric Lane, and Leo Honeycutt. We're also going to hear from Kim Ritchie Spencer, who's a co-author of a book about autism, The Thinking Mom's Revolution. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And for a few more moments, we're remembering Matt Batts, age 91. He died Sunday in Baton Rouge, and services will be held Saturday. Visitation at Ravenhorse downtown 4 to 6 with a memorial service conducted by Ken Ward. 297-5633, Eric Lane, Leo Honeycutt, and Denise Batts, and Chris Andrews, the Reverend Chris Andrews, calling. Good morning, Chris. You're on WRKF.
Good morning, Jim and Denise, Leo and Eric. I just wanted to express my condolences to Denise. I know your mother passed away just a short while ago, and now losing your father. But Mr. Batts was a member of First Methodist while I was the pastor there, and I always enjoyed reading him as he came in. He had a smile that would light up the world and a grip that would crush your hand. Those are the things I remember about him. Wonderful man, pleasant always, and Denise, blessings on you and your family in this time of remembering and mourning and giving thanks.
Thank you, Chris. That means so much to us.
Your dad was a sergeant in World War II?
He was. He worked on the airplanes. Never liked to fly, but he always worked on the
airplanes. Well, Eric Lane, who was a catcher for 4 years in the minor leagues after a brilliant career at Tulane University, and I'm not overstating that, he's kind of the Crash Davis of our community. You remember the character in Bull Durham?
Yeah,
Kevin Costner played a catcher who had been a star in the minors who never made it to the big show. But a question from Roberta asking, who's the best catcher you ever saw?
Johnny Bench.
Well, get a little closer here.
Yeah, Johnny Bench, I've never seen anybody since Johnny Bench. I never had the pleasure of watching Matt Batts catch, but, you know, the people that I saw in my era, Johnny Bench is the best.
Well, Johnny Bench was a great hitter, with 389 home runs, I believe. But you're saying just catching.
Catching. He was a great hitter, too, but his throws to second base, I've seen very few people ever throw like that.
And he could hold like six or seven balls in his hands.
Huge hands. He came to Lafayette a couple of years ago, and I went to the function he was at just so I could meet him for the first time. I was so nervous, I stumbled over every word.
Yeah. Well, catchers quite often get banged up like no other player in baseball, that crouching, and it's a tough position. And they have some
fighting with the umpires.
That's true, too. And
Skip Burton.
And the fact that your dad made it to 91, was he in reasonably good health?
He was in good health. Yeah, he actually on his 83rd birthday shot a hole-in-one, so he was still playing golf up until the last year or so.
Do you recall the course?
CCL, Country Club of Louisiana.
Really? Yeah, so he was still doing athletic things well into his 80s, and he lived to be 91 years old, played for Boston, Detroit, Cincinnati, the Chicago White Sox. He had a fantastic career in the majors, and it was broken up, his baseball career, by his service in World War II, like a lot of others. He did his patriotic chore. He must have been, he was born in 1921, so he must have been, what, about 20 or 21 when he went into the service?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so Baylor University.
He was a Hall of Famer there.
And ended up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And quite often we have people of significance living in our midst, and we never know about it. And Leo, here you write the obituary, and you never met the man.
No, I was supposed to meet him. Denise and I had talked about that, and he had good days and bad days there toward the end. And so we were going to try to catch him on a good day. In fact, I was going to go video it. And unfortunately, it just didn't work out. But his story is one of those things that inspires me, because I think people, especially in this area, need to understand that Matt Batts was from San Antonio. And so he only had really 10 seasons in the major leagues. So when he got out of the major leagues and retired from that and hung up the catcher's mitt in 1956, he could have gone back to San Antonio. But he had been doing some kids' clinics here in Baton Rouge because he had so many fans here that wanted him to come here. And he and his wife, Arlene, fell in love with Baton Rouge, so they chose to move to Baton Rouge and make that their home. And they wound up spending most of their lives in Baton Rouge.
Well, Saturday.
So you see, we always talk about how Louisiana is not a good place to be and people want to move away. Well, here's an example of somebody who created a great opportunity for not just themselves but for us. And they had Batts printing that went forever, and they sold that. I mean, it was just a great success story all the way around because they were givers.
Well, Mike Rhodes, who we know well, the former Channel 2 sportscaster, says Matt Batts was an unsung but true legend who finished very well as a man. He was a friend to everyone and was instrumental in helping put Baton Rouge baseball on the map. And I'm sure Mike and Eric and Leo and many others will be on hand Saturday at Ravenhorse downtown to say goodbye to a baseball legend who died at the age of 91 on Sunday. Thank you, Denise, and sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much.
And good to see you, Eric and Leo.
Thank you.
Okay. And we're joined now by Kim Ritchie Spencer. She is one of the authors of The Thinking Moms Revolution, inspiring true stories from parents fighting to rescue their children, autism beyond the spectrum. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, and this is something that affects far too many people. It's a major part of our society now as far as parents who are dealing with children who are autistic.
Yes, the numbers are astounding. They truly are.
Well, how does it look right now? As far as I hear numbers like, it's certainly less than 1 in 100, isn't it?
Yes, the latest numbers from the CDC, counting school-age children between the ages of 6 and, I believe, 12, are 1 in 50, 1 in 39 boys. So it's a terrifying number, and it doesn't seem to be any end in sight as far as the numbers just, you know, continue to rise. It's terrifying. And, you know, at the Thank You Moms Revolution, we have many kids in our group that are dealing with autism, but a lot of other illnesses, and the numbers are even more scary if you understand that 1 in 2 American children have a chronic illness. So if you count autism spectrum disorders, diabetes, obesity, autoimmune disease, half of our children are sick. So it's more than just autism. There's really a scary thing going on.
The Thinking Moms Revolution is a group of 23 moms and one awesome dad from Montana to Malaysia. They've all had children with developmental disabilities. And one of those is our guest, Kim Ritchie Spencer. You say scary things are going on. Could you expound on that as to why you think that's the case? Why is this occurring?
Well, I think there's a multitude of reasons. You know, we just live in a more and more toxic world. And another scary aspect of it is that mainstream is not really catching up with what needs to happen to help these children. So that is kind of how the Thinking Moms came together, was that we just really weren't finding what we needed from our doctors and pediatricians for our children to improve and get better. So we kind of had to depend on each other and network with each other and figure out what it was that we could do to help our children. And what we figured out and what mainstream really isn't helping us with is that our children, although autism is and these disorders that are happening are really labeled psychological or mental disorders, we figured out that our children's problems are really medically based. So if you treat inflammation, or you treat heavy metal poisoning, or you treat food allergies, and you treat seizures, you know, and the GI disorders and all these things that come along with our children, instead of treating autism, which basically might be an antipsychotic that's not improved, you know, approved for children's use anyway, and that's about all they might hand you, and then you figure out how to handle these medical issues, then our children get better. They potty train, they mainstream, they talk, they socialize, they quit slapping, they quit having seizures. And so, you know, we just had to depend on each other to figure these things out, and now we just are trying to get the rest of the world to understand that. You don't have to just take the answers that your pediatrician has given you. There is more out there if you look for it.
The range of autism is broad. Its manifestations can be slight, or they can be major. Of the ones that are displayed in your book, The Thinking Moms Revolution, these families who have struggled with this, what is the range?
We have a little bit of everything. My son is 12 and one of the older kids in the group. I think the average age of our children is 9, or 8 in the group of the 24 of us. My son is very high-functioning, going into 7th grade and mainstreamed and has friends and plays on the computer. And, you know, he has a close to typical existence on this planet. But some of our kids are very ill, kids that don't talk yet, kids that aren't potty trained at age 8, kids that have seizures all day long, you know, kids that are on fire are not potty trained. And it's just, it's a really sad situation. Although, you know, we have found answers and these children are improving. Each and every one of us have seen great results in trying different approaches to our kids' health. But, yeah, we're all over the place as far as functioning.
What generally happens to these kids when they become adults?
Well, that's a big concern at this point. You know, there's about to be a huge wave of these children, you know, that are set out of the school systems at about age 21. So there's many people out there that are really trying hard to figure out how we're going to pay for this, how we're going to house them, what we're going to do about this wave of children that's coming along, and it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight. And so, you know, at the Thinking Moms, we really do feel a responsibility to find everything that we can to help our children. We want our children to be taxpayers. We want our children to contribute to society. We don't want it to be a drain on society and, you know, Medicaid in our country. And so that's part of why we're asking people to think is we can't sit by and let this happen. Who's going to pay taxes? Who's going to rule our, you know, country? Who's going to take, who's going to work? It's terrifying to think that, you know, we're headed to a place where there's going to be very few people left to do what needs to be done to run our country.
Kim Ritchie Spencer, she is Blaze in the Thinking Moms Revolution. That's a good name.
There's a story behind it, but we don't have time for that.
Well, maybe we do. Is it related to Blaze Star?
Well, you know, I have a background in advocacy and activism, so I think one of the girls is responsible for having nicknamed all of us, and it really was based in blazing the trail and trying to make a difference with all of this. So.
You say, I believe with all my heart that if we can save one child from the fate of human-induced health problems, we can save the world.
Absolutely. I mean, one child saved is just absolutely the mission. Anybody in Baton Rouge today that hears, you know, me on the radio and says to themselves, wow, you know, my son's not talking, he's four, the doctor said go give him some speech therapy and fight for an aid at school, but that's my only answer, maybe some Abilify and just deal with it. And says to themselves, wow, maybe I can find the Thank You Moms. Maybe I can look deeper into this. Maybe I don't have to absolutely 100%, you know, the sentence that's been handed down to me by my pediatrician and finds more for their child. That's our mission.
How did the Thinking Moms Revolution come together?
We have to thank Facebook. There has been a network since I've been in the autism world throughout, you know, all kinds of social media, Yahoo groups and just anywhere out there, but in Facebook, we were able to share a little bit more with each other than we ever had before, pictures of each other's children, comparing treatment stories, and we all, the 24 of us, were in a group together on Facebook that we all were using the same practitioner, and there were about 50 of us in that group comparing notes, figuring out, you know, the best way to do it every day. And became really good friends, met each other at Autism One conference. It's in, every year in Chicago. So we met in person, and as we were sitting there, someone says, we all need to write a chapter and tell our stories and put it together and find a publisher so that we can get our stories out there into the world and tell people that there's hope and healing and that you have to network, you have to find your support amongst others.
All right. In South Downs, Lauren is calling. Lauren, good morning. You're on with Kim Ritchie Spencer. Hi, Lauren.
Good morning, Jim. I'm calling on behalf of Baton Rouge Speech and Hearing Foundation here in town. And we offer a variety of autism therapies for young children with autism. And just to give a little local perspective, I know, Kim, I believe you said it was from Montana or you know, greater parts of the country. We have found that based on 2010 census data, we did a little research and found that about approximately 620 children in the capital region will be diagnosed with autism spectrum disorders just between the ages of 0 to 5 per year, and that's just in greater Baton Rouge. So
Wow. We've
really kind of heard from parents exactly what she's saying, that you need to kind of bind together and find the hope in the situation. And we've really been able to offer that through some of our multidisciplinary programs, whether it's speech therapy, ABA therapy, occupational therapy, and combining those things in totality. So I just wanted to offer that for your listeners and to thank your guests for speaking out about this subject.
All right. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Well, how has this affected your relationship with your spouse?
You know, I'm one of the lucky ones. My husband has been very trusting of me to do the research and pick the right things that fit our pocketbook and fit our lives. And he has been an amazing guy. He raised the money to put Project Lifesaver, which is a tracking device in our county. He's raising money right now for a local horse therapy center in Savannah. I live in Savannah, Georgia. And back to what Lauren said, very interestingly, I love my husband. He's awesome, and I'm so lucky. But I just wanted to add, in Savannah, my special ed director told me a couple of years ago that they had gone from serving 30 children with autism in my county to 300 in a matter of 6 years. So if that tells you anything, I mean, just like she's saying in Baton Rouge, your numbers are 600 a year. That's astounding.
620.
And where is the shock? Where is the awe? Where is the action? What is anyone doing about this? We don't really see that there's much happening at all. So sound the alarms. People need to pay attention. This is a scary thing happening to our children.
Well, thank you for sharing your story, Kim Ritchie Spencer, one of the co-authors of The Thinking Moms Revolution, Autism Beyond the Spectrum. Thank you.
Thank you, and we will be at the Baton Rouge Barnes & Noble Saturday from 1 to 4.
Baton Rouge Barnes & Noble Saturday 1 to 4, and we'll find
Absolutely.
Out which one when
we get City Place.
City Place. There you go. Yep. Thank you, Kim. Thank you for listening, everybody. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.